listening to The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Sunday, March 10th, 2019, and this is a live edition of The Realist Report, broadcast here on eurofolkradio.com. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of The Realist Report podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, with that said, I'd like to introduce our special guest this afternoon. Dr. Kevin McDonald should be joining us. I am going to attempt to contact him right now. I wasn't able to get him on the line before we went live. Let me try to call him right now and see if we can reach him. So hang tight for just a minute. And let's see if we have Dr. McDonald on the line. Dr. McDonald, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, very good.
Sorry, I forgot what time it was.
Oh, no, it's okay. I know we just had a daylight savings time. I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Now not so much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear. Should I put on earphones? Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, no, you sound good. I just, it might have been just when Skype picked it up. I received a little bit of a feedback. I could pretty much hear what I was saying. But no, you sound good. And thank you very much for joining us. You've been a... Oh, and I think we just lost Dr. McDonald again. Let me try calling him back one more time. Sorry for the technical problems. We should be recording live at least right now.
I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem at all. No, yeah, I was just saying, you know, you've been a guest on this program a number of times, so I want to thank you for taking the time to join me once again. We always have a really interesting conversation, and I've learned a lot, excuse me, from your writings over the years. You are a former university professor and an author, and you're also the editor of the OccidentalObserver.net, which is really an excellent website, one that I have followed closely for a number of years. So,
Appreciate that. Thank you.
You do great work over there, and definitely staying busy and active. And I know you guys also publish a print journal as well, the Occidental Quarterly, and that's published. Yeah, I guess it would be quarterly, right? So four editions every year. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Four issues every year.
Very good.
The spring issue is at the printer, and it is on the website.
Very good. Yeah. So I know you are definitely staying busy with what you're writing about, and the topics that you guys address at the OccidentalObserver.net, and of course in the pages of the Occidental Quarterly are very, very important. And today I kind of wanted to talk about a number of, I guess, kind of recent political developments. So let's just kind of jump right into it. The first topic I wanted to talk about was the CPAC conference. And I believe it took place, it was last weekend. I think it started not last Thursday, but the Thursday before, and then it ran throughout the weekend, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't follow it all that closely. I mean, I was kind of seeing the headlines. I didn't really see any of the speeches. I didn't even, you know, sit down and watch Trump's speech. He got up there and spoke for like 2 hours or something like that. It was a very long speech that he gave. You know, it seemed kind of lame. I did hear that, I think her name is Michelle Malkin. She's like this Asian, conservative writer and pundit. She's been on Fox News a lot. She always has some really good things to say. She apparently gave the best speech there. You know, she was pretty much the only one up there talking about immigration and, you know, building a wall and many of the things that President Trump ran so successfully on. So, just to get started, did you follow the CPAC conference? Do you have any, you know, hot takes on it?
probably about at the level you did. I followed it mainly on Twitter. Everybody's talking about the Michelle Mulliken speech. I had a feeling if she had vetted her speech before it was delivered, like, you know, in the program or something, she would have got disinvited because there was almost no mention of immigration there. You know, this is a standard establishment Republican kind of thing. They, in general, the vast majority of the people running that thing are pro-immigration Republicans. But, you know, I'm sure a significant number of the attendees were tuned into that. But, yeah, it's a disappointing thing. People who were more on our side were systematically excluded. There were people like Peter Brimlow managed to get in there without press credentials, so he just paid his way in. And the person working for him, Faith Goldie, got in, and she gave some updates about it, some comments on it by video. And I did see some of those, and she was pretty good, in general. And one of the tables there sported, they were selling hats or giving away hats saying, "Make Israel great again," you know, that kind of thing is very common at CPAC.
Oh my goodness, I did not see that. I did follow Faith Goldie's coverage of it. That was pretty much the only thing I was really paying attention to was, you know, kind of like the alt-right journalists and you know, activists were doing at the conference. And yeah, that was the big story in my mind. I wrote a piece for American Free Press kind of highlighting the conference, and that really was kind of what I focused on. I thought that was the biggest story of the whole weekend, was the fact that, you know, top young conservative activists and journalists, like a guy like Patrick Casey, for example, and also Nick Fuentes, who is very, very impressive in my mind. He does a YouTube show, and he was actually recently, just earlier this, I guess it would have been last week, I think it was like on Tuesday or Wednesday of last week, he was invited by the college Republicans at Iowa State University to give a speech, and he showed up, and it was, you know, a big mess. They didn't have a room to do it in. The people that invited him basically, you know, backtracked and kind of disavowed him, and, you know, it really didn't turn out too well. But he ended up giving a speech outside in the cold to a crowd mostly of BLM activists, it looked like. So they were like far left wing activists that he was speaking to. And it was very interesting. And Fuentes is, as I mentioned, very, very impressive. I think he's got great takes. He's very articulate, very intelligent. You know, he's really good on a lot of the issues. So CPAC is up there banning these guys. And, you know, as you mentioned, they have tables for people that are selling hats that say, "Make Israel Great Again." I think that kind of shows where their priorities are, right?
That's it. I mean, and really, it's a sad commentary on the conservative movement and the Republican Party, really, that these people are still, you know, prominent enough that Trump goes and speaks at them. And, you know, of course, he's got his own problems. But, that's the reality that we have to deal with.
Yeah, and it's pretty typical. I mean, this sort of stuff, this is, I guess, to be expected, you know, them banning people like Patrick Casey or Nick Fuentes. Anybody that, you know, espouses any sort of pro-white political perspective is systematically discriminated against and targeted, and ultimately kicked out of CPAC conferences. You know, you can't even give them money to attend their lame conference. Did you get a chance to see the press conference that they gave? Faith Goldie was also involved in it. They live streamed a press conference. I think it would have been on Friday night of the conference. I could be wrong about that, but it was in the evening on either Thursday or Friday. And they apparently rented a separate room at the convention center that it was at. And they gave a press conference where they talked about how they were, you know, basically banned from the conference. And, you know, they were talking about a lot of the issues that we care about that are important to the people that voted for Donald Trump, right? And, the press conference was really good. I got a chance to see that. As you were saying, it really does kind of expose just the state of mainstream conservatism in the mainstream Republican Party. I mean, it's just a total joke. I have a question for you. Do you think that the GOP can be revived?
Well, it's just going to be very, very difficult. Certainly Trump, the party, you know, seemed to go, Trump has a lot of support, even on his immigration policy among Republicans, but by no means unanimous. I think if Trump was reelected, you know, and it would take some time. But things could change, you know, if Trump, of course, Trump has to get his head screwed on right too. And he was recently calling for increased legal immigration. What's that about? It's just, crazy. And, so, you know, unless it happens that way, I mean, I think this was sort of that Trump's election was a sort of model of how it could be done, where you have somebody who just comes from out of nowhere and spouts some really good ideas on immigration, and other things and gets elected, you know, contrary to all the probability. There's a miracle really in a lot of ways. That's what could happen if some, Republican candidate, got out there in the primary trail and really, you know, voters resonated to him enough that they couldn't stop him. Just the Republicans couldn't stop Donald Trump. And then, you know, he actually did something. But, you know, as we've seen, as soon as Trump got, started his presidency, there's an unprecedented, unbelievable campaign in the mainstream media and, just hatred on the left. And again, so many never Trumpers on the Republican Party. These neocons are still, going on and on about it. So it's an uphill struggle at best, but yes, it could happen. If someone really attractive gets out there with some money behind them, and starts saying things, well, you know, you still have the primary process. It's hard to shut it down. And so it can happen again, but, you know, very difficult.
Yes, no doubt about that. And see, that was the thing about Trump is, you know, when he came on the political scene and you know, announced his run for presidency, yeah, you know, everybody was very enthusiastic. It's like, finally, somebody's saying the right things. Finally, someone is speaking our language. Although, you know, he wasn't, you know, explicitly pro-white by any means. He was just denouncing political correctness and talking about immigration, talking about building a wall, you know, things that we certainly care very much about. You know, immigration is probably the most defining issue of our lifetimes, and it continues to be, and it will be into the future. And, you know, he was saying a lot of good things about immigration. Once he got in, it was, you know, a totally different story. He's really been a huge disappointment in my mind. And really, things seem to have changed dramatically. Really with the State of the Union address. I don't know if you caught the State of the Union address. I don't think I watched the entire thing. I did watch most of it. And boy, it was just, it was terrible. I thought it was absolutely ridiculous, some of the things that he was saying. And he's been very disappointing. And really since then, it's just been one thing after another with him. I'm very skeptical if the GOP itself could ever be revived. I think Trump has kind of proved that it really can't at this point. And you see, even like when young activists do get involved with the GOP, I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named James Alsup. He was involved like with the college Republicans when he was at school. I think he went to Washington State University, if I'm not mistaken. So he was involved with the college Republicans. He was a big, you know, Trump supporter, a Trump organizer. He started a YouTube channel. He was actually involved with Nick Fuentes for a while. I think that they were doing like a regular podcast. And, you know, he started doing other podcasts and whatnot. Excuse me. And he actually got elected as like a local precinct officer for the Republican Party. He won an election back in, I think it would have been 2018. And, you know, he promptly got expelled and like kicked out of the party basically. Because again, you know, he's talking about pro-white issues. He's talking about illegal immigration. He's got a great YouTube channel. For anybody not familiar, I'd highly recommend checking out his work. And, I actually wrote another piece for American Free Press highlighting the fact that, you know, he was basically expelled from the GOP because, you know, he's not a mainstream conservative, right? I mean, he's talking about immigration and race realism and some of these topics. So, I mean, I think it's kind of been proven that the GOP is basically a waste of time, and, you know, it's just going to shut down and exclude people like us, people who have ideas like us. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it definitely doesn't look like the GOP is going to help us in any way. And I don't think that we can even, you know, attempt to influence it. When we do, we get banned or shut down or kicked out, like James Alsup, like these guys showing up at the CPAC conference and getting banned. So it's very disappointing. I almost think that, you know, we need some sort of brand new party or something. And of course, we know how difficult that is in American politics, you know, getting, you know, a new political party up and running and, you know, gaining traction and whatnot. It takes a lot of work, a lot of money, and we certainly don't have a lot of money on our side, unfortunately. So I'm kind of jaded and very skeptical of the mainstream GOP establishment at this point. I think Trump has really kind of proved how disappointing and just total sellouts that they really are.
Yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, as I say, the only way it could happen within the Republican Party is a top-down sort of thing where, you know, some populist manages to sway Republican voters against what the establishment wants, which is what Trump essentially did. It was a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. But, you know, it's never been, you know, all that deep into the Republican Party. And huge sections of it are very opposed to all that. They're, you know, they tend to be Chamber of Commerce types, they big business, they want cheap labor. They're terrified of being called a racist, and they are, you know, very militant against anyone who takes explicitly pro-white stands. That's just the third rail. They, as you say, they'll be expelled. They'll be shut out of meetings. They'll be vilified by these Republicans. So, yeah, it's going to be very difficult and impossible to change the Republican Party. And we're between a rock and a hard place here. I mean, even if we stopped immigration, you know, right now there's more non-white babies born in this country and young children than white babies. You know, this demographic transformation is upon us, and we have no force really to roll it back. Even, you know, Trump promised to end birthrights. He proposed ending birthright citizenship. Well, it just died. He never mentioned it again. But that's the kind of thing, and especially if you do things retroactively, start deporting. But it's hard to see how you can really change it, things at this point, without an explicitly pro-white kind of thing where we say, look, we got to change the demographics here. We got to, you know, have political power in, you know, explicitly pro-white, just as Jews say have in Israel or something like that. It's just a long way off. It's just hard to see how it can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of immigration, I'm looking at a piece here published by the Epoch Times, which is kind of a more conservative news outlet that I've been following pretty closely lately. They put out a lot of good pieces, a lot of good articles, a lot of good information. Headline here, illegal border crossings on pace to hit almost 1 million this year. Yeah. You know, you see headlines like this and you just look at the reality on the border, what's going on down there. And you hear like mainstream, even mainstream Republicans, but certainly, you know, pretty much all of the Democrats, they're up there saying, oh no, there's no big deal. There's no border crisis. You know, everything's fine. You know, we can let these people in here. There's no crisis, nothing to see here. It's like, it's so astounding, like how disconnected from reality some of these people are. And in this piece, it talks about how, a lot of these people come, you know, attempting to enter the United States. They're bringing, you know, they have like children with them that aren't even their kids. There's a lot of deception, a lot of fraud involved with a lot of their documents and paperwork and stuff like that. And if I understand it correctly, I mean, you basically show up at the border, you know, say you've been persecuted or, you know, oh, hey, I can't go back to my home country, et cetera. And they pretty much let you in and they set a court date in the future, which 9 times out of 10, these people don't even show up to. So, I mean, literally our country is being invaded and we're not doing anything to stop it. And the man who ran on a platform of dealing with this problem, you know, again, can't seem to get anything done. So the entire situation is just totally out of control. And we see a lot of, you know, immigration hawks who once supported Trump, you know, being very critical of him now. A guy like William Gein from the, I think it's AliPak is the name of the organization. You know, he was a big Trump supporter. He's been very critical of him now. Has been critical of him for the past probably year or so. Ann Coulter has been very critical of President Trump. And Trump is even out there attacking Ann Coulter now. I don't know if you saw on Twitter. I'm sure you did. Yeah, he called her a wacky nut job, Ann Coulter. Wow, what a disgrace this guy is now. So I guess go ahead.
As you say, I mean, what's happened here is that people, pro-immigration forces have made laws so that if someone shows up at the border with a child, they can't detain him more than a very short period of time. And now they just flooded the border with so many people that they can't put him up anywhere. So they have to release him. Once they're in the country, as you say, they will not report for the court hearing. They are here. So that reality would be that there are 1 million, they're over like 1.5 million legal immigrants a year and 1 million illegal. So it's gotten a lot worse. It's sort of like in Trump's face, from his originally. I mean, I don't think he really wanted this. I do think that when Trump got in, he wanted the best. He wanted a wall. I don't think he was being duplicitous about that. It's been it's been very difficult. And, you know, as much as I like Ann Coulter, I thought she was overly harsh in some of the things that she said, but, you know, she's certainly right, you know, about this, some of her criticisms of Trump. And I totally agree with him. When it comes to the wall, you know, he made a very bad deal. But he says now that it's going to be funded. But even then, people are going to show up at ports of entry or wherever, as long as they have a child. That's the ticket. And so all these people are just finding kids and bringing them up, and they may be their kids, they may not be their kids. And, you know, the advocates are already down there. In fact, I saw a story that they were actually, the Border Patrol was detaining people at the border and questioning them and so on, who were U.S. citizens who were going into Mexico. But the reason they were going was to organize these caravans, to organize the migrants who are coming up here. So it's all very organized, very orchestrated. They want to change the face of this country as fast as possible. And, you know, they're succeeding. We have no leverage. You know, we have the courts. It's just very, very difficult to go up against this power.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking of Ann Coulter, I've been following her for a long time. She's always had a lot of really good things to say, I think. There is an event out here in Los Angeles called Politicon. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's it's pretty much a mainstream type conference. They do bring, you know, more conservative figures like Ann Coulter. Ben Shapiro was there, for example, and some other kind of mainstream conservatives. And there's also, you know, like the far left side too. So it's like a political conference designed for people, you know, all across the political spectrum. And Ann Coulter was there, and I got a chance to see her. To hear her speak, and she also participated on another panel discussion. And she's always been very good on Trump. You know, she's been very critical of him. And her biggest criticism always has been, why is Trump appointing people in his administration that are not on board with his Make America Great Again agenda? Why is he appointing people that aren't on board with building a wall and dealing, you know, seriously dealing with our immigration crisis? And there's a number of examples that we could go through. We don't need to do that right now, but Ann Coulter's been critical of him for a long time, and rightfully so. You know, maybe she has been a little, you know, too hostile towards him, perhaps. But I think she, you know, a lot of the criticism she has raised and continues to raise are entirely valid and legitimate. And now, apparently Donald Trump, he was following her on Twitter for a long time. And then apparently he stopped following her, and now he's again openly attacking her. And let me just read the tweet that he put out here. This was just yesterday. He said, wacky nut job at Ann Coulter. So he's like, you know, tweeting at Ann Coulter. Wacky nut job Ann Coulter, who still hasn't figured out that despite all odds and an entire Democrat party of far left radicals against me, not to mention certain Republicans who are sadly unwilling to fight, I am winning on the border. Major sections of wall are being built and renovated, with much more to follow shortly. Tens of thousands of illegals are being apprehended, captured at the border, and not allowed into our country. With another president, millions would be pouring in. I am stopping an invasion as the wall gets built. Hashtag MAGA. I just have a hard time taking what this guy is saying seriously anymore. I mean, I just mentioned the piece I earlier, you know, I cited the article published by the Epoch Times. You know, we have millions of people still coming into this country illegally. So how can you get up there and say that you're dealing seriously with immigration and getting the wall built and all this other nonsense? I don't know. I just can't take the guy seriously anymore, to be honest with you. It's very, very disappointing.
Yeah, I agree. I do think he may, you know, build some sections of the wall, but until you take care of this legal issue that anybody coming in there can claim, you know, refugee status, and we can't do anything about that. You could put, you know, the whole military down on the southern border, but until you deal with that law and you build, you know, a wall that's 100 feet high, you can't deal with the problem until you deal with changing the laws. And Congress will not do that. And, you know, and I think one thing that's happened since Trump got in is that it's made the Democrat Party more to the left. They've never been this far left anywhere remotely like this. You know, I mean, you can easily get videos of Schumer and Hillary Clinton and Pelosi and just about everybody could, you know, condemning illegal immigration. No Democrat's ever going to say that now. So they've just gone full bore. And, you know, if and when they get in again, which would probably be 2020, they'll get in. God knows what they're going to do. They'll either get 4, 5, 10 billion a year. They can't transform this country fast enough. But I think the polarization in a way is good because, you know, we have to have polarization. And, you know, being in the middle doesn't work, obviously. We need extremes and we need white people to get more and more extreme politically. And I do think white people are getting it to some extent. I think that the fact is that, you know, the fact that even Trump got elected overwhelmingly by white people means who are willing to listen to these populist messages and vote for him means that they are, you know, they're willing. And when the Democrats get in, I think there's going to be real fear among an awful lot of white people that this is the end of the world. And it may well be the end of the world unless something amazing happens.
Yeah, well, one thing that Trump is right about is that the entire Democratic Party is certainly working against him, no doubt about that.
Oh, and
not only the Democrats, but even a lot of Republicans. And I mean, generally speaking, the mainstream mass media has clearly been working against him from the very beginning. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. I mean, of course, there are some
viciously so. I mean, all these
Oh yeah, yeah, very, very much so. And he really has polarized things and really brought out the true nature of the Democrats and the radical left wing.
What they really want.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no doubt about that. I don't know. I guess it's just, see, this is the thing that is crazy. Like, despite all this, like, he knows this. He recognizes this. He said as much in these tweets to Ann Coulter. And yet, you know, like, during the State of the Union, for example, he's up there talking about how he wants to, you know, bring people together and work with the Democrats to get things done. It's like, dude, don't you see that these people are not trying to work with you? They're trying to do everything in their power to arrest you and lock you up and, you know, get you out of office. These people are not playing fairly. They're not playing nice. And yet, you know, his attitude is, look, you know, we need to come together and work together. That's not happening. I mean, he needs to get much tougher, I think. And you know, I mean, think about like the whole situation where there was the big debate about him declaring a national emergency. It's like, man, you should have declared a national emergency months ago. I mean, we have a crisis on our border, clearly a crisis. You know, people are just flooding in. We got to do something about it. And, you know, he's so far largely failed to act. So I don't know. There seems to be a big disconnect. Like, he recognizes all the forces working against him, and yet he wants to try to somehow work with them. It doesn't make sense to me. I really don't get it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense to think that he can get anything out of Congress now. And, you know, it boggles the mind that you had a Republican-controlled Congress for 2 years, and nothing was done good on immigration in Congress. I mean, they could have built a wall. They were in control of the budgets and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, of course, they still need 60 votes in the Senate. They say, you know, all that stuff. But it's impossible to work with those people. And that's the crisis of our democracy. And I despair, really, of getting our interests fulfilled in any way within the democratic system at this point. It just doesn't compute anymore. By the time white people are aroused enough, cohesive enough, and determined enough, you know, the possibility of winning an election is going to be long past. So,
I hear you. I hear you. It's a very difficult spot to be in, no doubt. You know, one last thing about Trump, and you had mentioned it in the CPAC speech, and he mentioned it in other speeches as well, maybe even in the State of the Union. I can't remember off the top of my head. But, you know, he's up there talking about how we do, in fact, need more immigrants. We need legal immigrants to come work in all these factories and businesses that are setting up in the United States. You know, this basically is totally contrary to a lot of the things that he was saying when he was running for president, and even, you know, when he was first in office. We have got to make it absolutely clear that we do not need any more immigrants at all. We have plenty of people here in this country as it is. Too many, in fact. Some of these people got to go back. So this idea that, oh, you know, the economy's booming, and that really seems to be like his main talking point, is that, you know, he's done so many things for the economy. He's brought all these jobs back. All these businesses are moving back to set up shop in the United States. So we need more workers. I mean, this is just a losing argument. You know what I mean? This is totally contrary to a lot of the things that he said. And, you know, who buys this? do any of these people at CPAC really buy this? I mean, I don't know. Maybe they do. But I know the people that voted for him, his base, are not on board with this. That is for sure.
Yeah, it's either because he wants to virtue signal that he's not really a bad guy. He's against illegal immigration, not legal immigration. Or, you know, it's just part of his economic pitch, you know, that things are doing so well under my watch that we need more people here. The reality is workforce participation is still very low and has been since the 2008 recession. The people got out of the workforce. They went on disability. They just did all kinds of things to get, but they're not working, and that's the reality. There are plenty of people, and you know, if you have an economic boom, you know, without all this massive immigration, you're going to have rising wages. That's just the way it works. And that was one of Trump's main pitches, you know, about how he wanted to bring back factory jobs and good paying jobs and all that kind of stuff. Well, you're not going to get that if you flood the country with cheap labor.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I want to move on and talk about some other recent developments. I'm, you know what, at this point, I'm kind of getting tired of talking about Trump, because it's just, I don't know really what more can be said about what's going on. It's, again, just very disappointing. But I did want to talk about the growing anti-Semitism scam, as Phil Girardi recently described it. Yeah, he wrote a piece. And when I first contacted you to set up the podcast, I had sent you a link to this article that was published over at UNS.com. This was back on February 19th, so almost a month ago. The growing anti-Semitism scam, and he has a quote here from Joe Sobrin, quote, "An anti-Semite used to mean a man who hated Jews. Now it means a man who is hated by Jews." That's so accurate. And, you know, much of this piece deals with the comments made by the Somali-born U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, I believe is her name, where she's, you know, basically pointing out the obvious, easily provable fact that the pro-Israel lobby has tremendous influence over the United States federal government, over Congress, They play a huge role in the, you know, how people are elected. That's very clear. That's very obvious. And she's basically pointing this out, and it's caused all sorts of hysteria from the left, from the right, from pretty much the entire mainstream political establishment and media establishment. Of course, the organized Jewish community has been outraged by her comments. Even more recently, she was giving a speech at a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and she was talking about how many people have dual loyalty to Israel and to the United States, and, you know, how that's, you know, sort of problematic, right? I mean, you know, how can you serve two masters, right? Again, she's pointing out some very obvious and basic facts that are very rarely brought up in mainstream political discourse. And, you know, you see the reaction. It's quite incredible. Did you get a chance to read Phil's piece over at UNS.com?
I did. It's an excellent piece. I mean, I've been writing a lot about these issues and more recently tweeting about them, you know, for a long time. It's really true, you know, that these are true facts. There's, you know, what chutzpah do you have to say that it's about the Benjamins, meaning, you know, the funding of the Israel lobby? That's what really accounts for a lot of the support for Israel. I mean, what chutzpah do you have to say that is just pure anti-Semitism? It's crazy. And yet you see, I mean, I follow the ADL online, and that's immediately they came out like that. You know, columns by Brett Stevens in the New York Times, by Max Boot in the Washington Post, and they just say this stuff. But it's so obvious. And Phil Giraldi, you know, in his article, documents, you know, all the phenomenal support. The AIPAC has a budget of $229 million a year. They have all these activists. They take every freshman congressman to Israel for a, quote, orientation tour, which is obviously a propaganda tour. And one, the other thing about the article that I've been noticing for the last few years is that as criticism of Israel increases, what they are doing is conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Israel. It used to be that they would make this distinction. You know, you can criticize Israel, but you just you can't you know, criticize Jews, you know, when their allegiance to Israel or something like that. But now any criticism of Israel is now being seen as criminal. And you know, France, Macron, the president of France, just stated that they were about to do that, that he was going to recommend that soon. But it's become you know, these anti-BDS laws, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, where, yeah, you can get, there are penalties, financial, criminal penalties for criticizing, this, you know, an attempt to boycott, Israel over its policies toward the Palestinians. And this is a very powerful group. And this is for exhibit A, really, of Jewish power in America.
Oh yeah, no doubt about it. I've been writing about the concept of anti-Semitism for a very long time as well.
Yeah,
and it's really incredible. I mean, if you look at the way that word is used by the organized Jewish community, by groups like the Anti-Defamation League, for example, you know, what they consider to be anti-Semitism, how it's manifested publicly, it basically does amount to just criticism of Jews. Criticism of Israel, you know, again, stating basic, easily provable facts about Jewish power and influence in this country. There's that epic, you know, Joel Times article that he wrote for the Los Angeles – sorry, what was his name? Joel Stein. Yeah, Joel Stein, yeah. He wrote this piece for the Los Angeles Times that you can still find online. You know, basically, the article is titled, Who Runs Hollywood? Come On. And, you know, he's a Jewish guy, and he's basically laughing at how people, you know, freak out when somebody brings up the fact that Hollywood is run by Jews. And he proves it in his article. Like, literally, every single major studio, essentially, in Hollywood is run by a Jew. You know, we see many prominent Jewish individuals in the mass media. You know, we see a lot of ownership of the mass media by Jewish individuals, who many of whom have direct ties to Israel. So, you know, again, making like these basic points and just pointing this stuff out is the organized Jewish community considers it a form of anti-Semitism. It's just, I mean, it's insane. It's absurd. But it's been very effective in shutting down any sort of debate and shutting down, you know, people making these basic observations. Yeah. And, you know, it's a very taboo topic. And, you know, again, it's clearly on display with, you know, the situation with Ilhan Omar. When she first made the comments a few weeks ago, the House immediately passed a resolution, you know, condemning anti-Semitism and everything. They did so again just last week. And I'm looking at an article here published by the Times of Israel. Let me just read some of this briefly and I'll get your take. The headline here is, U.S. Jews divided by House resolution condemning anti-Semitism and bigotry. While some Jewish groups and leaders applaud the measure, others lambast it for not mentioning Ilhan Omar by name or being watered down by inclusion of other types of hate. So the House resolution is not good enough for some of these Jews. And I'll read just a little bit more here. It says, a House resolution condemning anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry appeared to heal a rift in the Democratic Party, but revealed divisions within the American Jewish community Thursday, with some groups welcoming the measure while others lambasted it as watered down. After Democrats spent days deliberating over whether or how to reprimand Representative Ilhan Omar for comments that critics said amounted to accusing Jews of having dual loyalty to America and Israel, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a motion that denounced various kinds of hatred, including anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Weeks earlier, Omar apologized for insinuating that the American Israel Public Affairs Committee paid politicians to be pro-Israel. But the bill, which was approved by a vote of 407-23, and by the way, the 23 people that voted against it, they voted against it specifically because it wasn't, you know, harsh enough, you know, condemning Ilhan Omar and harsh enough condemning anti-Semitism. That's why they voted against it.
I saw a video of Lee Zeldin, the congressman from New York, saying exactly that.
Yep.
When they said a pure anti-Semitism resolution, it was 424-0, I believe. That was in the Giraldi article. Yeah, I mean, that's the power that they have in getting raked over the coals by McCarthy. And, you know, the Republicans virtue signaling by saying, we must condemn her for, you know, it's a joke.
Yeah, yeah. Let me give you a quote here from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, who were, you know, they were outraged at this motion because, again, it didn't go far enough. They say here, we commend Speaker Pelosi's decision to bring to the floor the issue of anti-Semitism within its ranks. The politically expedient resolution failed to call out Representative Omar by name and failed to take into account the historically unique dimensions of the anti-Semitic themes trafficked by Representative Omar. Ron Lauder, who is the president of the World Jewish Congress, imagine that, they have a World Jewish Congress that operates at the global level to advance Jewish interests. Ron Lauder, he also was not too happy with the resolution. He says, quote here, the House was regrettably chosen to water down the resolution, thus sanctioning Representative Ilhan Omar's remarks, which put the loyalty of American Jewry into question. All forms of bigotry and xenophobia, including Islamophobia, should be condemned, but we must not forget the specific nature of anti-Semitism within the current climate of anti-Zionism and rising attacks against Jews. So, you know what? I guess it just proves that, you know, there's nothing is ever good enough for the Jews, right? I mean, we don't give them enough money to Israel. We're not condemning anti-Semitism, you know, quickly or fast enough or forthrightly enough, apparently. I mean, you just cannot please these people.
You know, one of the things that the Simon Wiesenthal Center said that you just read off there is that these are historically significant statements about Jews, that these have been historically what people have said about Jews. And they've been historically true about Jews. And that's the thing. You know, again, it's been true. If you look at the history of anti-Semitism, you can easily find disloyalty accusations going back centuries, and at least 200 years. Especially once Jews really got in the mainstream of European history in the 19th century, this is very common. And Jews have used their money to influence the political process, obviously, and advance Jewish interests. So that's the reality. But again, what they've succeeded, this is just a measure of their power, that they're able to silence this, to put it, to make any criticism of Jews as a group, or even individual Jews, if they relate to typical criticisms that have been made of Jews, it's off the table. You cannot say that. And they've succeeded largely.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just amazing.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, who was the last congressional leader or just anybody, in Congress? Who was the last person to ever, bring up some of these things? The only one I can think of is Jim Traficant. I mean, back when he was in Congress, he was, exposing the Israel lobby and being very critical of it. I remember also Senator Chuck Hagel. He made some comments as well that caused some outrage when he was basically saying, "Look, I'm a U.S. senator. I'm not an Israeli senator. I'm here to advance the interests of the people of my state and the people of this country." And just saying something as straightforward and as simple as that generated all these accusations of anti-Semitism. So, it's really just kind of an absurd clown world situation we're dealing with when it comes to these accusations of anti-Semitism. And I gotta tip my hat to this Representative Omar. I mean, I'm not too happy that, she's even in our country to begin with. I think she should probably go back to Somalia where she's from. But she at least is exposing these things. And there have been a lot of people that have supported her. A lot of the kind of growing far left radicals within the Democratic Party, people like this other freshman representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, these people are out there supporting her, saying, "Hey, look, we should be able to say these things." And really, what we should be condemning is Islamophobia, not anti-Semitism. So it's pretty interesting what's going on with the Democratic Party. There seems to be kind of a growing divide over like the mainstream party that's pro-Israel and pro-establishment versus kind of the more radical left-wing faction, which is playing a bigger and bigger role in the party, it seems like.
That's right. And certainly it's a concern to Jewish activists what has happened in the UK with the Labour Party. This used to be a party that Jews tended to support. And even after they started deserting Israel and getting more critical of Israel, you had a lot of Jewish money going to the Labour Party. But then you got Jeremy Corbyn all of a sudden. And this is, he's extremely critical of Israel. And he allows these, quite a few Muslims now, because there's such a large Muslim population in the UK. They are significant, when in their voting patterns. And so the party pays attention to them. Well, there's been, two-year-long uproar in the UK about, quote, anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And what it really means is, Jeremy Corbyn is critical of Israel. Again, you see this conflation all the time now. Criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. And so that's basically what it comes down to. But it's happening more and more. And as you say, the people on the radical left, I mean, if you are a radical leftist and all you do is you spot all this virtue signaling about how, we're all one and we should admit the world and invite the world here and all that. Well, how can you support Israel with their apartheid policies, with their border walls, with their restricting immigration to only Jews, with their two-tiered legal system, and even apartheid roads now where only Jews can be on these roads? So this is an amazing thing. And if you are on the left, how can you possibly say that, that you support Israel and have the same positions you do in America on, diversity issues?
Right, exactly. Hey, by the way, did you see Trump's response to all of this, where he was out there saying that the Democrats are an anti-Israel, anti-Jewish party?
Yeah.
Did you see it? I just caught a brief video of it.
It's just an example of how the Republicans are in general. And the pathetic thing is the Republicans use this as an opportunity to virtue signal to the Democrats. You know, we're more virtuous than you. And how do you know that? Well, we're more pro-Jewish. We're more pro-Israel. That's the standard that they're trying to use here. And of course, it falls on deaf ears anyway. The Democrats could care less about that. They're not going to, care. Anything right. that Trump says is just beyond it. The hate is just palpable.
Yeah, and you know, I actually sat down and read the recent resolution that they adopted, and you know, it's interesting how the resolution itself. I mean, it basically protects. And Angelo John Gage had a good tweet about this. The resolution itself, it basically protects all these different groups. It protects blacks, Asians, Native Americans, you know, yeah. Hispanics, LGBT, of course, Jews. Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, the one group of people that it doesn't, you know, explicitly protect is whites, is white Christian people, the very people that founded and built this country. So, you know, our entire political system is just fundamentally, governed by this central paradigm of, you know, anti-whiteness, really. That's what it all boils down to. Exactly. Is we live in a country that is basically anti-white. It's not okay to be white in America, or really any other Western country at this point.
Yeah, they talk about it. The resolution talked about hatred against minorities. You know, so that's explicitly excluding whites and hatred of whites from this resolution. So hatred of whites is just fine. And the resolution, as I recall, also condemned white supremacy. You know, this is this code word that the left invented, you know, for whites who may want to keep political power, as every majority group in every country wants to do. So it's a horrible resolution. And again, it just shows really the sad state that we are in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's and it's again, it's being made very clear, very crystal clear. It should be, anyways, to everybody out there paying attention. You know, we only have a few minutes left. There's a couple other topics I wanted to get into. And I was actually just looking at the OccidentalObserver.net shortly before we went live, and you guys just republished an article that Andrew Joyce wrote. Jewish efforts to restrict free speech in the UK. 1945 to the present. And this is a theme that you guys have covered over the years at the Occidental Observer. You've written about it. Other writers for the website have written about it. And if I'm not mistaken, is it generally accurate to say that the organized Jewish community, maybe back in like the 40s and 50s, they were like the leading advocates for free speech and for, you know, getting their communist, left-wing, radical, anti-white ideas pushed into the mainstream and accepted. And then once they basically were able to institutionalize their narratives, now they're the leading proponents of restricting free speech, of shutting down quote-unquote anti-Semitism and quote-unquote hate, terms that they themselves get to define. Is that basically accurate?
Yeah, on February 28th, I posted a blog item on that. It's a phenomenal thing, really. During the 1950s, Jews were the vast majority of people who were called in front of Senator McCarthy's committee, the hearings that he held. You know, if you look at the spy cases, like almost all the Jews who were investigated or convicted communist spying at the time were almost all Jews. And so the organized Jewish community were in a tough spot, and they tried to rally support within the Jewish community for anti-communism. But, you know, it was a pretty hopeless case because the far left was was very much ensconced in the mainstream Jewish community. There were like the American Jewish Congress or components of the American Jewish Congress, which was the largest by far Jewish organization in America. They were avowedly communists. And there were just a huge Jewish subculture of communism. Well, of course, they were being hauled up in front of McCarthy and other, the House Un-American Activities Committee, far disproportionate. And Jews were terrified about that. So they wanted free speech. They wanted people to be able to, they wanted communists to be able to express themselves, because at the time, the anti-communist movement was very strong. And McCarthy, and so these universities, for example, require professors to have loyalty, to sign loyalty oaths. And there were the blacklisting in Hollywood, where they pressured the Hollywood studios to fire screenwriters who were associated with the Communist Party. And so, at that time, Jewish organizations were gung-ho for free speech. And what happened was they actually instituted a culture in favor of free speech. The famous Jewish playwright Arthur Miller, who married Marilyn Monroe for a while, he wrote a play called The Crucible, in which the villains were these Puritans in Salem, Massachusetts in the 17th century who were going after witches. And that's the analogy was very clear in everyone's mind that this was, this was basically an analogy with the McCarthy era in Washington, D.C. So that was the Jewish response when Jews were getting investigated and felt they didn't have free speech rights. But now every Jewish organization, without exception, and that's been true not only in this country, but throughout the West, whether it's France, England, Australia, wherever, they are all, and in this country, the ADL, the look at the the hate crimes legislation, all that. They want restrictions on free speech. And it always has to do with expressions favoring, opposed to diversity, talking about, white interests and that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing they want to shut down.
Oh, absolutely. And they've been extremely successful.
Exactly.
And again, they are not, this is no secret. I mean, you can follow the ADL or like the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example. And, they're releasing, press releases talking about how they're openly working with Twitter and Facebook and YouTube to combat quote unquote hate and anti-Semitism. And, you hear a lot now, one thing that you, with this whole scandal with Representative Omar is, a quote-unquote anti-Semitic tropes, which are basically, truthful, accurate statements about Jewish power and influence. They describe them as tropes. They want to shut these ideas down, anybody expressing these sorts of ideas. It got me thinking, you see a lot of truly anti-white tropes out there, like this myth of, white privilege. Yeah. And, it got me thinking, it's like, man, we need to come up with some sort of word that, we could use like anti-Semitism, because you see how truly weaponized it has become and how effective it is. Yeah. And, we're out there getting accused of having white privilege and all this other nonsense. And I don't know, it was just something I was thinking about, relating to all this. It's like, how do we flip the table on, turn the tables on them and, use one of their own tactics against them. I don't know if we even could, but... it's just something I was thinking about. They're up in arms about these quote unquote, anti-Semitic stereotypes when all day long, whites are being accused of having privilege and, being responsible for all the problems in the world, for oppressing other people and stuff like that. When those narratives truly are tropes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they really are. It's, again, this is a very, very powerful group. The example of the ADL working with Twitter and Facebook to shut down this sort of thing. So the ADL does all this activism. They got huge amounts of money pouring in to support them. The Southern Poverty Law Center the same way. And that's basically a Jewish organization with a secular twist to it, or supposedly. And yet, when you talk about Jewish power or influence, you're seen as horrible, anti-Semitic. well, what's all this activism for, if not to advance their interests? You know, I mean, we're supposed to think things. It's like, you know, up is down, true is false. It's just like 1984, where you have to not only say things that are false, but believe that they are false, even though the truth is staring you in the face. That's the world we live in now.
Yes, you're right. Very well said. I couldn't agree with you more. Dr. McDonald, we are pretty much out of time. We're going to have to wrap up. I just wanted to plug your website one more time, theoccidentalobserver.net. Definitely be sure to check out the website if you're not familiar with it. And also, you are pretty active on Twitter. I'll have a link over to your Twitter profile as well, so you guys can follow Dr. McDonald on Twitter. Well, thanks a lot, sir. I appreciate it. You know, this whole Trump situation, it's again, very disappointing. I don't know what else can be said about it. We'll just have to...
Yeah, we're sort of pessimistic today, but, we can never lose hope completely, okay? Never lose hope.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it. I will talk to you again real soon.
Yes. Okay. Enjoy it. Let's do it.
Bye.